Yeah, I think we were just talking about it. Part of like what I'm hearing and seeing, I think for us, like with some of our younger friends, the tendency is we watch something like this and the attitude of demolish. Like, I am now going to wreak havoc on all of the old system and burn it to the ground and try to do something. You know, and we're talking like, and we've, the, what I shared with you, that idea of renovate, is more like, how do I approach this and recognize I cannot fix all of this in one moment, but I must approach it and put my hands on it, and just like God is in process with my life, I'm going to engage in this process and begin to work it out.
Yeah.
Rather than burn it to the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. Although, I do think higher education is poised right where the Roman Catholic Church was on the eve of the Reformation.
Yeah.
I think in every way, higher education right now is the Roman Catholic Church on the eve of the Reformation, and we need reformers.
Yeah.
Now, Luther and Calvin went too far. Zwingli especially went too far. You don't have to burn down everything, right. You know, and they don't want to take it down. But we cannot keep what we are doing. And my daughter just graduated from high school on Thursday, and I saw this up front. There were those kids up front, who don't have an eye, a very small class. Had, for them, it was a big class, it was 40. But you had about 20 of the students with all the National Honor Society garbs and all of the nice little tassels. And my daughter was one of them. Then you had about 20 of the students. And the clear implication was, guess who were the winners and guess who were the losers. And I felt so bad for those other 20. Because I know some of those kids. And they're great kids. And in many ways, they're going to have a better future. Because they're going to be electricians, the plumbers, on an island, those are the people you never have met. You know. If you're a plumber on an island, you're king. So I'm looking at them, seeing the pain that they had to go through, they kept their heads down the whole ceremony. As the other ones are being celebrated, brought up to the front, congratulated. I mean, this is wrong. This is wrong. Ken Robinson wasn't going to say it, and this is going to make some of you mad maybe, but I'm out of here. I do not believe there is such a thing as ADD. I don't. We have, in this country, over 4 million kids diagnosed with ADD, attention deficit disorder. By the way, 4-to-1 boys to girls. So basically, I mean, what we used to say, boys will be boys, we now say, give them a class 2 controlled substance. I want you to hear this. A class 2 controlled substance. You sell this on the street, you go to jail for 10 years. This is on the same pharmacological category. This is the same pharmacological category as cocaine. Ritalin and cocaine are class 2 controlled substances. It's the same thing. But we are popping these into our kids starting at age 4 and 5 because we would rather drug our kids so they can learn like we feel comfortable teaching them than to change our educational methods to fit their learning styles,
right.
Which are very new. By the way, those of you in worship, parents don't want to keep their kids on it 7 days a week, so they take them off on Sunday. And guess where they send them?
Church.
So you wonder why these kids are climbing the walls and
not there because the parents can't sit with them in worship.
Yeah. So we are. At the same time I say that, I also want to be gentle with parents, okay? Because every parent has done things to their kids that the succeeding parents go, how did you ever do that?
Yep.
Started with bloodletting. Anybody remember tonsils?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, every kid in the 50s and 60s, the first thing you had an infection, you got what? Yeah, now they don't want to talk about it. Then my first kids, remember when they were born, they either had their feet going this way or their feet going this way? Anybody remember this? And so you had to put them in special shoes and braces. You ever see any more of this? Nobody wants to talk about this. See? Oh, no, we didn't really do that. Yeah. And that's why I think this is a medical fashion. It's a medical fashion that one day we will repent of and we'll say, how in the world will we ever do this? So I don't want to be too hard on parents, but let me tell you. I also know we do not know the implication of what it's like for kids that have been on a class 2 controlled substance for 15 or 20 years to try and get off of
it. Right. Yeah.
And I have one kid in seminary who tried, who said, I'm going to get off this, and he developed Tourette's syndrome. I mean, just getting off. So this is the degree to go, we will go, especially boomers. My generation, but younger still. Not to change. There's a problem with Ritalin, it works on everything. You get it to me, I can really focus really well all night long. I can get all sorts of work done. It works on everybody.
Yes, guys.
We gotta do some different things. And we gotta find, you can't drug them to sit and worship. We gotta find ways of worshiping. And this is where I thought the key of this whole little clip is the aesthetic versus anesthetic.
Right.
And we've done anesthetic worship for so long. Let's start doing aesthetic worship. Let's engage all of the senses, including smell. And release it in the glory of God, for the glory of God. Comments?
Bringing this up, really recently hearing about this debate going on within world of psychology and analysis, and they're getting ready to release the Bible of mental health, and there's a huge debate going on. Thoughts on that and its spiritual implications? Because there's basically, I think in England, they're rising up and saying, well, this whole thing is a mess. We don't even believe in any of this anymore. Is there anyone talking about that in religious and spiritual circles at all?
Now we have more important conversations, like, what's the difference between a deacon and an elder?
Do you have an answer?
That's what we think is so much more important.
Yeah.
And these are the conversations we ought to have. Exactly right. I want to define. I'm sorry.
One of the first foot washing services I did, we had a guy that was on Ritalin, and it's a little concerned how he would respond. After the service, he caught me out in the hallway. He said, "Can we do this again?" He was there.
Yeah. Well, that's their learning style. It's kinesthetic. Yeah. It's multi-sensory. Yeah. Academic what?
Doping.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, that's what they've been trained to do. But you go to South Africa, nobody's on ADD, nobody's on Ritalin, nobody's diagnosed ADD. I mean, you, the only place in the world, basically, you find this is here, and this is our treatment for a whole new learning style that we refuse to learn to come to terms with. I have not defined semiotics, and I really need to do that. We've only got like 45 minutes, so I'm going to cover a lot of stuff. I do want to leave you with a final Bible study in a kind of a more semiotic, like I did with Paul's back. I want to take another text to show you how to come at it. But here's this word semiotics that doesn't seem to have much meaning, or may sound a little strange. It's a very simple concept. And one of the first ones to talk about it is Jesus, who had a favorite saying, red sky in morning, sailors take worm. I'm quoting the Bible now. The red sky at night, sailors delight. And then he said, you know how to read the signs of the sky, I want you to know how to read the signs of the times. So part of what it means to be a disciple is the ability to read signs. Now the Greek word for sign is, guess what? S-E-M-E-I-A. We get our word from the semiotic. So it's basically the ability to read signs. And these signs are everything. Now for me, the ultimate sign is Jesus. So we want to read the signs of what he's up to so we can join him in what he's already doing. So he's the ultimate sign. He is the vision. We don't have to come up with our own vision because he is, I grew up singing a song, be thou my vision, O Lord of my heart. Yeah. So, the very fact we have to come up with our own vision means that we don't have the right one, because the vision is Christ. And we see what he's doing in our neighborhoods, in our zip codes, we join that. So that should be the vision. So the ultimate sign is Jesus. But what does it mean for us to read signs? The big thing now is reading body language. You see Putin and Obama together sitting over there. You talk about reading signs.
Yeah.
You could be a stupid semiotician to read that. There also was a tribe of semioticians in one of the 12 tribes. This was their gift. And you read this in Chronicles 12, first or second? Second. It's verse 32 where each tribe is coming to the new King David saying, this is the gift we offer you. There's one tribe that came to King David and said, this is our gift. We are the tribe of Issachar. We are the tribe that knows the times and knows what to do. Knows the times and knows what to do. That's where the wise men were. They read the signs. They were the semioticians. Pagan semioticians were better, actually, than the Hebrew ones. So it's very simply, how do you read signs? And we all learn to read signs very quickly. Anybody married? Dear, what's wrong? Nothing. squirt. But I know something's wrong here. Nothing's wrong. Squirt. But what does it mean to read the Bible semiotically? In other words, to read the Bible and to look for the signs. And ultimately, it's the sign of his appearing, the sign. But we're focusing less on hermeneutics than semiotics. So it's a shift from hermeneutics, which is the science of interpretation, to more of a science of sign reading. How do I read what's going on here? How do I read the images? We're going to have a little fun, and I'm going to show you how. Again, we did it with Paul's back. I want to do it again with another story that I already alluded to, but let's try it again. We could do a couple, maybe, and if we have time, we'll maybe do a couple. But one of my favorite stories in the Bible is the only story Jesus told where he gave a character a name. And that story of Dives and Lazarus. Now, Dives is not the guy's name. Dives is just the word for wealthy, a rich man. But he gives the name of his best friend, Lazarus, to the poor people. So what's going on with the story? Now, who can tell me the story? Who can tell me the story? Yeah.
Richman ate sumptuous every day. Lazarus was outside his door begging for scraps. And Richman essentially ignored it. Lazarus died when they were on his bosom. Richman died and opened his eyes. While he's there, he's asking God he's thirsty, he wants a drop of water. And he's asking God to send Lazarus over, but Lazarus, God says, it's a
chasm between
you. He's not told you. And he says, well, at least send someone back to warn my brothers to look for they don't come to this place. And that's very close.
And what is he told? Okay, even if somebody comes back from the dead, they're not going to listen. If they're not listening to... okay. Yeah, and that's really good. I mean, that's a really good telling of the story. And that's the traditional telling of the story. But...
Open our eyes.
But that's really not the story. You're guessing. That's the story that everybody thinks is there. But here's something about a Jesus story. Jesus' story always does two things. There's an upsetting and a reversal. Okay? In every Jesus story, there is an upsetting and a reversal. So if in the reading of the story, you're not experiencing that upsetting reversal, you got to question whether or not you got the story right. Because Jesus is going, you have heard it said, but... So he's reframing. He's taking a traditional way of looking at something and he's presenting it in a whole different way. Let me give you another idea. Every one of you here, this is a reframing. And this is a technical word, reframing. Cognitive neurolinguistics, this is a scientific name, reframe. Therapy is reframing with a new metaphor. You reframe your brain, meaning you really reboot it. You reboot it around a whole new story, a whole new narrative and metaphor. Every one of you has not at all what you've been driving. Every one of you has nodded off while you've been driving. You know what I'm talking about. They're called micro sleeps. You kind of nod off and you come back. Or am I the only one?
I know.
Yes. Suddenly everybody woke up. Yeah. Well, while you're driving, it's technically called a micro sleep. They have studied micro sleeps. And it's about 1.4 seconds. So you are now, when you nod off, it's almost 2 seconds that you are calm. So now you can remember the 1.4 seconds. Or you can remember the fact that 1.4 seconds at 60 miles an hour is the equivalent of one football field. So you have just traveled down the highway, one football field, asleep. See, now what I've done is I reframed math with an image. You got 1.4 seconds or whatever it is, or one football field. Now, I guarantee you, probably what you're going to remember is the football field. But just this is the key to effective communication. You tell, you make the familiar strange so it can become fresh again. You hear that? You defamiliarize. You make the familiar strange. So I made it strange. It's not 1.4 seconds, it's a football field. So you can then return to realize, my Lord have mercy, 1 microsecond, I've traveled the whole football field dead without knowing where I'm going. Somebody else is higher than mine. And that's what Jesus is doing here. Every story he's doing this. He's reframing, he's reformatting, he's rebooting. And this is what we've got to do in worship. We've got to find ways of reframing it so that people are not you got to route the routine. Even when it's liturgical, you've got to find ways of routing the routine so it doesn't become another routine. Because a routine is another name for a grade. You get stuck in it, you can't get out of it. Alright. So here we have the story. Now, somebody looked at, what is it, Luke 16? Is that where it is? Okay. Can you get the story up on the screen? And I want you to read it. We're going to read it semiotically now. And what we're going to look for, and you've been taught to trust the words. I want you to trust the story. When you trust the story, every single detail is important. In other words, Jesus chose these details for a reason. You see what I'm saying? We've been taught Jesus chose the words for a reason, and the authority is in the words. No, the authority is in the metaphors and the story. You know what I'm saying? I mean, this is a huge paradigm shift in your thinking. The authority is in the story and the metaphors.
When one aspect, Jairus looked and he saw the angels carrying Lazarus to Abraham's place.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of details like that. We're going to look at them right now. Yeah. But, so you've got to trust the story, trust the metaphors. You've been taught to trust the word. I want you to hear trust the story, trust the metaphor. So the first thing we got about this story, there was a rich man. Now, but this rich man comes with some qualifiers. What's the first qualifier? What does that mean? Who are the other people who are purple?
Priests.
Kings.
A king and the extremely wealthy. Okay. So now you are a person in the first century and Jesus is telling you this story. So immediately, in the first few words, I mean, clothed in purple and fine linen. You're going to think of a person. Jesus wants you to think of a person. Who's the person you think of today?
Present.
Bill Gates. Not a, he would have said this was a politician, but this is a rich man clothed in purple. So, huh? Okay. All right. So the point is, here's the semiotics of this little phrase here: the richest person you can think of, whoever that is for you. If it's Shaq, it's Shaq. But the richest person you can think of, for me, it's Bill Gates.
Yeah.
All right. Now, so you immediately got an image that goes with the metaphor without, but it's going to change for every culture, it's going to change for every time period. You know what I'm saying? This is a.
Yep.
And feasted sumptuously. Well, guess what? Guess what kind of food Bill Gates has?
Whatever he wants.
All right. And at his gate was laid a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores. Now, there's a who, and there are various translations here, but the clear is that he's desiring, meaning he's asking to be served, but he is being fed with what fell from the rich man's table. So it's not the guy, he's not giving it to him. But there's something about the sores, and this is an important detail. You got to trust the metaphors. We know about the detail of the sores, but the sores aren't just any sores. They're sores that what? Okay. So now, what did we just learn about? We've learned something about the rich man, who is as rich as you can imagine. But we learned something about Lazarus, which is what? Huh? As low as you can imagine. How low is low? He's got an advanced case of it. He's being brought to the gate, and he's got an advanced case of leprosy that's so bad that it's oozing sore. In other words, this is gross. And it's so gross that dogs are even licking. Dogs will lick anything. If I got a dog, I love my four dogs, but they can be gross. Now, okay, get into the story. What's amazing? First of all, you go, wait a minute, something's not fitting here. This is upsetting. It's reversing your expectations. Why?
They're supposed to live. They wouldn't be living at the rich man's gate. They'd be living out away from the city.
Yeah, where do lepers belong?
Away.
Away, because they're unclean. They are supposed to be out of sight. When they do get in sight, they got to wear a sign and ring the bell. So, this leper has no business being at the richest man's gate. Now, give me an image of the gate. David's going to try and get an image of Bill Gates' gate. No, I don't need to do that. No. But it's a beautiful gate. It's a gorgeous gate.
It could just be his house.
Okay, who comes in through that gate?
Status.
Huh?
Status.
The wealthiest and most important people of that culture. So now, what's starting to get upsetting, and what's starting to reverse?
Well, he's not that bad of a guy. He didn't
run. Okay, why is this guy? He's got all the power in the world. He's got all the security in the world. Why is he not saying to this leper, "What?
Get out of here."
How many homeless people you got living on your front porch? How many homeless people are you allowing to live at your gate? So the people hearing this are going, wait a minute. This guy, diabetes, is what? Doing more, not do. Now, I'm somebody who loves leftovers. I think leftovers are better than because you can play with them, you know? Mix and match. Anybody here not interested in the leftovers from Bill Gates' table? So what kind of food is this guy getting? So wait a minute. So we got to now reevaluate our judgment, quick judgment of Dives as this mean, selfish, uncaring, uncompassionate, rich person who doesn't care about the poor right outside his gate. No. All he's got to do is say, security, get the guy out of here. I can't have the president. I can't have the prime ministers. I can't have the president of the Bank of America and the General Electric coming through my gate, seeing that gross thing there. And he's not doing it. And people listening to the story going, I don't have anybody like that living at my front porch. I'm not feeding my leftovers to anybody at my gate. You hear what I'm saying? Okay. Now, here we are. The guy died. The Lazarus dies, was carried by the angels to Abraham's side. Now, that's a powerful image. You're exactly right. This is a powerful image. Being carried, another treated special. Gets special treatment. The rich man died, and he gets dumped. You know, I mean, that's the contrast. Jesus put contrasting as opposite as he possibly can. The rich guy gets dumped and falls into Hades and lifts up his eyes and sees Abraham and Lazarus at his side. Now, notice what he does. You can tell he's still a rich man, used to commanding people because he still treats Lazarus how?
Servant.
Like a servant. So he's still got this, well, Lazarus, at least send Lazarus here. And he doesn't ask to get out of here. He's just saying, you know, I'm anguished. I need some relief. And Abraham says, you received, Lazarus had bad things happen to him, you had all these good things. Now he's comforted here, you're in anguish. Again, Jesus is creating this huge contrast. Besides all this, between us and you is a great chasm that has been fixed, or those who would pass from here to you may not be able, and none may cross from there to us. And then he says something, again, proving this guy really has a caring heart. At least, if you can't take care of me, do what? I didn't hear it. Tell whom? I didn't hear it. Trust.
My father's house.
The story. Because this is the key that unlocks the story along with the name Lazarus. I'm still not hearing it. You got to get the details.
Raise someone from the family.
Thanks. Five brothers. Five brothers. How many brothers does he have?
Five.
See, you've got to trust the detail. He's got brothers. No, you get the details right. Because the key is right here. The key that unlocks the story is right here. You can't slip over. This is a metaphor. He's got five brothers. He thinks. Abraham says, they have most of the prophets, let them hear them. And he said, no, Father Abraham, but someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent. And he said to him, if they do not hear most of the prophets, okay. Now here's the problem. As good as Dives is, as compassionate and caring as he is, as tender as he is towards his own family and his five brothers, he's still where? In heaven. Everybody hearing this goes, he's doing more than I would ever do. He's extending himself more than I ever would. And I thought I was a good person. He's in hell. How come he's in hell? That's the question. How come Dives is in hell? The issue is not why Lazarus is in heaven. How come Dives is in hell? Because everybody listening to this goes, oh my Lord, have mercy. If that guy can't even make it, what's it like for me? And the key to this story is right here. Why is Dives in hell? Give me the image. The key to the image.
Because he didn't give the best of what he had, he gave just the leftovers.
You're getting close. But I want the image. Give me the image.
I guess he's saying that he didn't invite Lazarus to his table.
But what's the image? Let's connect it again. Who is Lazarus? Bingo. Who is Lazarus to Jesus? friend. He gives the name of his best friend to this poor guy.
No.
This is a story about the sixth brother. And Lazarus is in hell. I mean, Dives in hell because he didn't realize he had how many brothers? Because the real brother was Lazarus. And he never brought him into the table and treated him like family. You talk to anybody running a rescue mission? I just came back from, before I went to South Africa, I went to spend a day consulting with Salvation Army. They brought all their generals from all the continents and spent a day with me. You talk to anybody in the Salvation Army, the rich love to come to visit the poor, especially when the cameras are there and can be seen ladling out. The rich love to take care of the poor. The rich love to visit the poor. The live rich love to be compassionate and feed the poor. Try and get anybody rich to be in a relationship with the poor. And it's a whole different issue. And Jesus has more than a compassionate test. Jesus has a relationship test. And his question is, who's your Lazarus? You got a Lazarus? They don't belong in the front gate. The Lazarus need to become the sixth brother. At the table. Not eating leftovers, but sitting there with... You understand where I'm going with it? Okay, sure. This is the untold story of Lazarus and Dives. It's the story of the sixth brother. Trust the story. Trust the details. Trust the metaphors. And that's why Dives is in hell. He was doing more than anybody expected him to do in taking care of Lazarus. But all he did was take care of him. He didn't bring him in, sit him at the table, and treat him like a brother. And so then the question, again, who's your Lazarus? Who's your Lazarus? Who are you in relationship with that's your Lazarus? And if you don't have a Lazarus, guess what? When I was the current general of the Salvation Army, it's interesting, the Salvation Army is set up that you have a lot of respect for these people, the Salvation Army. It's the number one fundraiser in the U.S. And it's there for a reason. But the person who's the head of the whole Salvation Army worldwide is called the general. And by the way, it's interesting, they've set it up so the general literally owns all of the properties. It's not owned by the Salvation Army, it's owned by personally the general. I have no idea. I guess William and Catherine Booth kept the reins pretty tightly close to them. But current general, her name is Linda Bond. And I was really eager to meet Linda because she is responsible for the largest single gift in the history of American philanthropy. And somebody by the name of Ray Kroc died and left his wealth to his wife, whose name is Joan Kroc. And the Kroc Empire founded what?
McDonald's.
And Joan Kroc gave, would you hear this, to Linda Bond $1.5 billion. Now, everybody else would say gave to the Salvation Army, but if anybody's in fundraising, you know, people don't give to institutions, they give to people. So I was really eager to meet Linda Bond because now, by the time they got this money, it was over $2 billion. So it's actually a $2 billion. Even though it started off, it's called compound interest. What are the besides the Holy Spirit, the second most powerful force in the universe.
Used to be.
It's still pretty powerful. Anyway. So it's now over $2 billion, a $2 billion gift. And I said to, we had said to the general, you got to tell me the story about this gift. She said, well, you know, it was a great blessing. You know, gave me all the pies. And I said, no, Linda, I want to know how you got this gift. She said, well, I didn't get the gift, the Salvation Army. No, Linda, you got this gift. I want to know how you got this gift from Joan of Arc. Well, I established a friendship with her. Yeah, I knew that, but how did you get this gift? Well, she found out I was the 13th child of a minor. I said, now why did that resonate with Joan Kroc? She said, well, Joan Kroc, before she met her husband, she grew up in Chicago. She was very poor. In fact, she was very young. The family, the father abandoned the family. And so her mother was a single mom trying to do all she could to raise these kids and had no money. And I said, okay, but how did you get this gift? And she said, well, it just so happened that every Friday night somebody from the Salvation Army would show up at their home. Two bags of groceries every Friday night. And that saved that family. I said, so they didn't have to go to the Salvation Army to get the groceries. She said, for some reason, something told that Salvation Army officer to bring it to them. And it meant all the world to the mother and to the kids. They didn't have to show up. The Salvation Army, they brought those two bags of groceries. And every week, those kids live for those two bags of groceries. I said, do you know the name of the officer who every Friday night brought those groceries? Does anybody know the name? Nobody can remember. Here's a guy who faithfully, summoned by the Spirit, showed up, and I'm sure at the end of his life thought, I didn't do anything significant. I'm just served the Salvation Army, did my best. But his faithfulness, $2 billion. Because he was faithful to the Spirit. You have no idea what those little things that you're doing today, being faithful to the Spirit in little things. 70 years later, who knows what will happen? We don't need to know. We don't have to know. It's not many ways for us to know. It's for us to be faithful. To do what the Spirit is called. To break the rules. It's not the rule to take two bags of groceries to somebody's home on Friday night. You break the rules of and a $2 billion gift comes out of an anonymous person's faithfulness. Nobody knows his name. Nobody knows who he was. But the biggest gift in the history of American philanthropy, he's responsible. Now, she brokered it, and Joan Kroc gave a little bond, because you give to a person. But that's a hero. Unsung, anonymous hero. A few years ago, this was more than a few years ago. I'm a baby boomer, my generation. So, you know, baby boomers, when they take over anything, have to change it. So when they were taken over to Salvation Army, they wanted to change it. And so they brought me in thinking I would agree with it because I was known as kind of, you know, futuristic. So they bring me in, and their mistake was they didn't talk to me ahead of time. But they just thought I'd support them. And the thing, the crusade was, we were going to get rid of the uniforms. We're going to get rid of the bell. We're going to get rid of the band. And they bring me in. And I go, you got to be crazy. You know what you pay to have a brand identity like this? I mean, when people think of Salvation Army, they think of three things immediately. First of all, they think of the bell. They think of the bucket. They think of the uniform. And they think of the band. Now, you can play a little different music. It doesn't matter. They don't think of the music. But you don't get rid. You pay. People pay billions of dollars for this kind of identity over the years. I mean, no. So then they got mad at me. And, you know, I betrayed them and all this stuff. But every one of your churches needs, you've got to create that kind of identity. The identity comes from stories, from images, from unique songs. I mean, you already can tell IWS has some brand identity. You not only have a logo, but you've got a way of singing the Lord's Prayer. That's yours. I don't know where you got it from. I don't know how you got it, but it's your brand. I mean, so the worst thing you can do then is, oh, let's experiment with another. Let's do the Milan version this time.
They try.
No. So you create these huge identity markers. And the more you can provide people with these identity markers, these are not ruts, these are identity markers that mark who you are, that create your identity. I'm not going to time to another Bible story, but comments, questions before we...
That challenge of what's a rut and what's a
grain,
that's a challenge.
It is a challenge. It is. Yeah. And that's why I think I have in my own life randomizing rituals that get me out of my ruts. For example, if you recommend to me in some fashion, even on Twitter, if somebody recommends to me a book or a movie, I have to read it. In other words, it's an automatic, because I'm trusting that it's not easy to get to me. So the Spirit has arranged things to the point where you actually get close enough to eyeball me and say, have you read this book? Do you need to read this book? Or something like that. I have to read it. Before I get on a plane, I go to Hudson News. For every hour, I buy at random one periodical. And I close my eyes. I don't go high. And I pick out if it's a 5-hour flight, it's a 3-hour flight at random. And the rule is, I have to look at every page. I have to read every word of every page, but I have to look at every page of those magazines during the flight. I mean, I'm sitting there really embarrassed reading Knitting 101. But I have never read something that I've not gotten a metaphor, an idea. See, this is what creativity is. You bring in difference. You juxtapose difference. So I have these, when I'm sitting at a restaurant, I have two allergies, I have shellfish, and I have some certain kind of almonds, but I will say to the person who's waiting on me, what's your favorite thing on the menu? And that person, if they don't say something has one of those two things in it. If I'm doing a randomized ritual, I say, I'm going to have your favorite thing on this menu. Now, the other thing I've just now done is up the quality of the service, because I'm now in a relationship, because that person now has heavily invested on my liking what she likes. And so I'm going to, but I'm not doing it for that. I'm doing it, see what I mean, to get out. Because here's what happens. The older you get, the more you know what you like and you don't like. And the more you have the power to control what you like and you don't like, and to give yourself what you like and you don't like. So the older you get, what happens to your world? It gets smaller and smaller. And we got to find ways of blowing that out. So these randomizing rituals that flout and arouse the routine.